think about the cup. Not about all the things that you've done. Just think what tomorrow can do. So don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. It'll soon be here. It'll be much better than before. Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone. Oh, don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. It'll soon be here. It'll be better than before. Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone. Oh, don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. It'll soon be here. It'll be so much better than before. Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. It'll soon be here. It'll be better than before. Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. With me in the studio today for Subversity is Chris Collette, who's a recent graduate of the PhD program here in political science at UC Irvine. And he's already done a lot of work, a lot of polling. And he's a political scientist who's also a poster. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
You're a specialist on fourth parties and or third parties, I mean.
Third or fourth.
Third or fourth or fifth. And, you know, people are going around blaming Nader for this mess in Florida. But, you know, I was thinking maybe it's actually Buchanan's fault because some people are voting for Buchanan by mistake, apparently, in a part of near Tampa or somewhere in Florida. What do you think? Are third parties always blamed for the loss of one big party or not?
Well, third parties are usually blamed for something or other. I think that what we're seeing really is a very gradual yet significant trend towards alternative parties simply because of such strong dissatisfaction with the two-party system. The arguments that Ralph Nader made, and I think quite effectively, really parallel those that are made by all third party, or rather I should say alternative party candidates, about the two major parties simply being that there's no difference between the two of them. While it sounds like a bit of a cliche, it really is an effective argument. I think that the American public does tend to agree with it and is searching for alternatives, real alternatives.
How can you say that if he only got like 3% of the national vote?
Well, the vote for an alternative party candidate is really determined by the dynamics of the election between the two major parties. And in such a contested race, a tightly contested race between the two major parties, a lot of potential Nader voters and to a much lesser degree Buchanan voters would have voted for those two candidates had they thought that one of the two major parties had a greater stronghold on winning the election.
Here's what Nader had to say when he was asked this morning by a reporter about whether he actually, his, you know, numbers caused the mess in Florida and caused maybe Gore to apparently lose, at least right now. So here's what Nader had to say.
First of all, I really don't know the way these figures play out. He's here, Tom Brokaw, he thinks that that was not the case. By the way, I do think that Al Gore cost me the election, especially in Florida. And that's far greater concern than whether I was supposed to help elect Al Gore. Secondly, if you want a prediction that isn't numerical, listen to Senator Ted Kennedy, who told a friend the other day that if Al Gore wins, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is going to be more influential. I think, regardless of whether Al Gore wins or not, if the Democrats interpret the election the way you just suggested, that the Green Party drew away its discouraged progressive base into a fresh, new, exciting party, then win or lose, the Democrats are going to have to reevaluate themselves on the political spectrum. And they're going to have to decide whether they're going to return to their roots of really fighting for labor and the people of this country, or whether they're going to continue to interpret election strategy by taking issues away from the Republicans in order to become more like them, in order to defeat them in Dick Morris's triangulation approach. Yes.
So that was Nate talking today. What do you think of that?
Well, I think he's essentially right, except on one thing, and that is that it wasn't the Green Party per se that affected the outcome. It was Ralph Nader. It's important to distinguish between the two, although it may upset some Green Party activists. It is really a Nader phenomenon more than the Green Party per se.
You know, one of your colleagues in the Poli Sci department here, Marty Wadenberg, did a book about the election of Reagan, and he found that it was actually personality, not ideology. It was Reagan's kind of personableness that actually got him the won him the election back in the 80s. And so people, American people, tend not to vote on based on issues as much as personality. Is that correct?
Well, I think what Marty found in his book was simply that the American public did not necessarily agree with Reagan policies, but continued to keep him in office for a variety of reasons, personality perhaps being one of them. Mm-hmm. But the American electorate is not so superficial. What was behind the Nader phenomenon was not so much personality, because I think most people would agree that Ralph Nader does not have the most compelling personality in the world. And in fact, when speaking to a public audience, sounds rather academic and almost bureaucratic, using a lot of polysyllabic words and philosophical language.
Sounds more intellectual.
He sounds much more intellectual.
Like Gore?
Gore and intellectual?
Well, compared with Bush.
Compared to Bush, but yeah. That's hardly a comparison.
Okay. So you're saying that he's more of a dynamic factor than the party itself?
Well, I think Nader represents a credible alternative to the two major parties, and this year he was the credible, articulate alternative. Buchanan and his brand of nativist right-wing politics simply was out of fashion with the electorate this year. In another year, perhaps, he would have done better, but this year, no. This time it was Nader's turn, and the opportunity for the left and the progressives in the United States to assert themselves.
But how come, why do you say there is room for progressives, but, you know, Bush got such a large vote, you know, why is there, isn't it awakening also the kind of right-wing tendencies that he got out, and isn't that why he may even win this election?
Well, Bush did not run the most conservative of campaigns compared to Republican campaigns in years past.
It wasn't family values as much?
It was
traditional values, I mean.
Well, Bush had a very coherent message throughout the campaign, one that I thought crystallized better than Al Gore's. And having been the incumbent party for 8 years, that is Al Gore and the Democrats, I think that Bush brought an anti-establishment, believe it or not, being the son of a former president, brought an anti-establishment approach to the electorate that resonated.
He said he wasn't a Washington insider.
Right, and that was at the crux of his campaign.
How come this latest, brouhaha didn't turn into a brouhaha over his maybe lying over whether he was arrested before? How come nobody seemed to care? Because it was so long ago?
Well, I think if you consider the past 8 years of the Clinton administration and the precedent that has been set, I don't think that a DUI 20-some-odd years ago is going to really get anyone too excited.
But, you know, I've had people on KUCI, on this other show, Both Sides Now, that premiered on KUCI a few weeks ago, and I had a person from Mothers Against Drunk Driving debating a lawyer from Laguna who was against sobriety checkpoints. And, you know, the point there was that the mad people actually have a strong lobby. So wouldn't you think they would be really freaked out and they would vote against Bush?
Not really. I don't think so. They're not a factor in the election.
I mean, from the exit polling, I know you're an expert on exit polls. I know that the little bit I saw on the web from the mainstream media's exit polling was that the people that voted for Bush did find it a factor that Clinton was a bad boy, and that therefore that influenced their vote. Is that right?
Well, to some degree, the numbers that I've seen showed that the exit polls found 3 in 10 of every American voter said that President Clinton was a factor in their vote decision for president.
But the people that voted for Bush, that went really high.
Well, two in 10 said it was a negative factor. 1 in 10 said it was a positive factor.
Oh.
So the president affected, say, 30% or 3 in every 10 votes, 2 of those being in a negative fashion, 1 in a positive fashion.
Although I think the figures I saw were of the people that had voted for Bush, and among them apparently was higher.
Well, I think that's to be expected. There is a solid core constituency in the United States that simply despises the Clintons.
How come nobody despises the Bushes that much? I mean, among the left, there's all this thing about dynasty, the Bush dynasty, that, you know, for generations they've tried to better themselves, move to another area, make a lot of money, and then, you know, leave it to their heirs. And except G.W. Bush did not make any money. All his oil investments went bankrupt, and his family bailed him out. And so his was a bad example, I suppose, but he got lucky this time, maybe.
Well, I just think that the antipathy towards Clinton is at such a peak among certain conservative elements of the electorate that they would do anything to expel him from office.
So to what extent is, you were talking earlier about Nader himself being a factor rather than the party. Why do you say that?
Well, because I am not convinced at this point that the organization of the Green Party, which has improved, I might add, enormously over the last 8 years, I'm not convinced that the Green Party per se is what's resonating and mobilizing voters. I think that Ralph himself had a message that appealed beyond simply people interested in Green Party politics or in the variety of philosophical issues that the Green Party supports and espouses.
You know, that's interesting because because he's arguing, I mean, I know a lot of people that vote for Nader never joined the Green Party, right? I mean, and they
right,
could even be registered Democrats, I suppose.
Right. The vote for Nader was clearly beyond the Green Party registration, no doubt.
And Nader was always arguing that that the Clinton, for instance, the Democrats have veered towards the right, and that he provides a kind of progressive voice that should be taken into account by the mainstream Democrats. And yet, when Amy Goodman asked Clinton that on the Democracy Now! Show that we aired in the previous hour, Clinton denied that the Democratic Party, that he had taken the Democratic Party to the right.
I don't know how he can deny that. Clinton has been a centrist since he was a governor of Arkansas. He was very significant figure in the Democratic Leadership Council. He's unequivocally a centrist Democrat, and to think that he has not brought the Democratic Party to the center, I think is quite a silly thought.
I'm going to fix this technical problem here. Let's see. We're on Subversity here with Chris Collette. So were you surprised at the 3% national vote that NADA got rather than what they tried to get was 5% because they wanted federal matching funds next time round?
Not at all. The polling continuously showed Nader at about 3 to 4%. I'm one of the few people, I think, in America that does trust the polls. It didn't surprise me at all, especially given the tight competition between Bush and Gore. What we saw in 1992, for example, was Perot getting a surge of support on Election Day because a lot of disaffected Republicans believed that Clinton was going to win the election anyway. So overcoming what we call the wasted vote paradox, Perot was able to gain a surge on Election Day, and Nader would have needed that type of surge in order to surpass the 5% threshold.
What did Perot get that time?
Perot got 19% in 1992.
And so do you think this would lead to the Green Party folks like giving up, or, you know, since they didn't get 5%, what do you think would happen?
No, I think it's definitely going to give the party momentum, and it should. Nader affected this election, and that has to be a wonderful consolation prize for him and the Green Party.
You don't think that the fact that he didn't get 5% would lead himself to give up? I mean, he's a pretty old guy, huh?
Well, perhaps it may lead him to give up, but I doubt it. He seems to me to be into this for the long haul.
How about the fact that if you can't get 5%, what, I mean, I think he did get 6% in some states, right? There's a few states that he got up to 6.
That I'm not certain of.
But at least from figures last night when I was looking. And does he have to get 5% nationally, or is it?
It has to be nationally.
To get the federal matching funds.
Uh-huh.
So what do you think he will, his hope, I suppose, do you think that he's going to get merged, and because if the Democrats actually lose, presidency, do you think that would actually, in the postmortem, cause them to go more to the left, or do you think it would not?
I don't think they really have a choice, the fact that Clinton has been so successful running down the middle, it would be easy for the Democrats to simply write off the year 2000 as a phenomenal blunder by a single candidate, Al Gore.
Do you think Gore made a mistake by basically leaving Clinton in the Rose Garden?
Absolutely.
And the Rose Garden strategy?
Absolutely. The distancing strategy, I think, was foolish.
Even though so you don't believe that he would have a bad effect on the electorate, Clinton's appearance?
No, not at all. I don't see how that could have negatively impacted the race for Gore, because Clinton has a mobilizing ability that the Gore campaign simply does not have. And as you saw in the last week of the campaign, Clinton finally came out of the closet, if you will, and was sent into essentially heavily black communities, African-American communities, to mobilize the vote. And he's extremely successful at that. And to think that he wouldn't be doing that type of activity throughout the campaign seems to me to be a very serious strategic blunder by the Gore campaign.
Do you think the Nader, on the other hand, blundered also? Because he didn't really bring up issues of race at all and that much. And although in the last week, I think he did show up with Reverend Sharpton at a church in Harlem.
Well, I don't know what credibility Ralph Nader has on racial issues or diversity. I think his strength is as a consumer advocate and as someone who is capable of rallying an anti-establishment movement behind an alternative candidate.
We actually have a caller on the line. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I am enjoying your political analysis. It sounds very astute. And I'm curious what effect you think the apparent Republican House, Senate, and White House coalition would have on the direction of the war on drugs.
It's very difficult to say, really, because the Republican Party, and especially if one paid attention to Tom Campbell's impotent campaign for the U.S. Senate, the Republican Party seems to be divided between tough on crime folks and others that are taking more of a libertarian approach to the drug war. That has been the great issue of the Libertarian Party, and I think one that has resonated, and obviously it's beginning to percolate in the Republican Party. And so I'm not completely certain. It really all depends, I think, on who obviously wins the presidential race and how that is going to dictate the dynamics in Congress.
Do you think it's time for libertarians to try and ply their anti-drug strategy within the mainstream parties?
Well, the libertarians have tried, I think, to lesser or greater degree to do that for the last 29 years of their existence. I think it can have impact on both major parties, really, but probably more so, I would say, with the Democrats than the Republicans, because if the Republicans become the establishment party, I think they're going to be hesitant to begin to recoil on current drug policies.
I think the Democrats, among the Democrats, John Graham, the guy from UCI, who was running against Cox, he came out strongly against the drug war in Colombia and support of this initiative that apparently that did pass in California to have drug treatment rather than incarceration. So do you think... go ahead, caller.
Oh, it just seems like there's more Republicans that are willing to denounce the drug war than Democrats, and is that a trend that you see continuing?
Well, I think it's easy for the Republicans to take that position, given the fact that they are not controlling the government. And I think that if they were in control of the government under the Bush administration, it would be much more strategically difficult for them to take that position, because it is not a position that is naturally going to be parallel with mainstream America.
You know, on that drug initiative, drug treatment initiative, were you surprised that it won, Chris, despite the opposition of law enforcement, basically?
It didn't surprise me too much, really.
Because of the money factor, George Soros was behind it, and a lot of, you know, big funders or what? Or you think the middle class, I mean, even white Americans have kids who have, you know, inhaled or done more, and so they really think it's too excessive to put them in jail. Even the DA here, Orange County DA, his kid was, his son was found naked in a truck with cocaine, apparently, or something nearby.
I think the message that we heard from Ralph Nader and have heard from elements of the Democratic Party that we're building more prisons than schools, that begins to, I think, shift the priorities and get people to think more seriously about alternatives to incarceration. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me.
Why do you put down the campaign of Campbell? Why do you think it was kind of...
He never had a chance to begin with. He's a very liberal Republican running against one of the most conservative Democrats in Washington, who has a large, widespread support, you know, pulling from independents and Republicans.
Dianne Feinstein.
Yeah, Dianne Feinstein. And Campbell simply never had a chance. He didn't have I think, a series of issues on which to run, and that is something that you need in order to pin an incumbent and begin to defeat her.
I thought
let me ask you this.
Go ahead.
If we do get a Bush administration and they appoint a new drug czar, do you see that drug czar as being more draconian or less draconian than McCaffrey?
My guess would be more draconian.
How about Medea Benjamin's campaign? I was surprised she only got like 1% or something. I mean, I thought she addressed a lot of issues. I mean, she's from, you know, she co-founded, what's that
group? Global Exchange,
right. And she and her husband, I guess, right? And, you know, she brought up a lot of issues when she was running around the country. And, you know, even when she spoke at Chapman, I thought she was, you know, pretty interesting for bringing up a lot of issues that nobody else addresses.
Well, Medea actually got 3% of the vote.
Oh, okay.
Which is not too bad of a turnout in statewide election for a Green Party candidate. So,
but she didn't get any press. And so I remember she was at us outside Santa Ana jail, and, you know, there were no reporters. Somebody from KLC showed up, and then I showed up, and then OCN showed up later, and they redid the whole press conference.
Well, she got press on two occasions, one for criticizing Dianne Feinstein's hairstyle, and the other for getting arrested the day before the election. So it's unfortunate, because alternative party candidates have to go to such extremes, no pun intended, in order to be heard. That, I think, creates a fringe and marginalized image among the public once that message does get out, and that's unfortunate.
What was she arrested for?
She was arrested for storming a debate, or perhaps it was an appearance by Dianne Feinstein, but I think it was a debate.
Do you have any predictions about the 2004 election, which way it would go?
Well, it all depends on what happens in Florida in the next 24 hours.
Do you have a prediction there?
I think that your next president is going to be George Bush.
You know, in the past, isn't it true that any kind of challenge to an election has never really overturned the results?
Well, it all depends.
The level, I guess. Which level?
Yeah, I think in some cases. I think in this instance that the margin is going to actually increase for Governor Bush.
Because absentee ballots are from, say, military bases and
yes.
stuff, they're more likely to
of
vote.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Subversity here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. To call, you can call 949-824-5824. Chat with Chris Collette, political scientist and poster. Any more comments?
That's great analysis. Thanks again.
Thanks for calling. So we're talking with Chris Collette about the election results. Do you think that, given the vote, I mean the what happened last night, that pollsters are to blame?
Well, if you actually look at the final polls that were taken by the major polling organizations. MSNBC, Reuters, CBS, ABC, Washington Post, Gallup, and the dubious voter.com battleground poll, they were all within about 3 percentage points, which, depending on the sample size, is within the statistical margin of error. So they all essentially called the race a dead heat, and in the end, it was a dead heat. CBS News had it closest by giving Gore a one-point advantage in the national vote. So I think that we demand a lot of pollsters, and the fact is that it is still an imprecise science, but it nonetheless does get us very close to what is going to happen on Election Day, and within a certain small percentage, and I think that for the most part, the pollsters were right in saying that this was a election that was too close to call.
But why did they call at the beginning? I guess the network said Gore was leading or had won Florida, right?
What happened was that the Voter News Service, which is an organization, coalition of media organizations that does exit polling on Election Day. Because exit polling is such an incredibly difficult and Byzantine exercise. The media have coalesced in an effort to try to set up this organization. And what happened was that VNS had oversampled Democratic voters, Democratic precincts, and so they overreported the Gore vote by about 3 to 6%. And so in their efforts to get the election results out to the public as soon as possible, they were hasty and called the state for Gore. What happens is that once CNN calls a state, all of the other networks will fall like dominoes in calling the state. And so the nation essentially thinks that Gore has won a particular state. And in fact, that wasn't obviously the case.
Why do they oversample Democrats?
I'm not sure what happened with the error, and I think that in the next few days, we're definitely going to know precisely what happened.
Or the network set up this voter news service, right?
Right.
So when one gets the result, the other ones get the other.
They all get the results, right. CNN is usually the first one to report, however.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
But why did they, why does, I'm losing my train of thought, but why do they report it as, why do they take it back then? I mean, how come?
Well, apparently they, VNS redid the analysis and then found Gore, then found Governor Bush to be substantially ahead. So VNS called the networks and said, time to retract our prediction. And this is what led to the drama and chaos on election night.
Is there a law saying that they can't call, you know, the results or predict the results until all the polls have closed, or is that just a understanding?
Well, that really didn't come into play. What came into play
What came into play
was the fact that VNS had oversampled Democratic voters, hence leading to a misreporting of a Gore victory.
Do they usually try to, predict it based on exit poll rather than actual results?
What VNS does is they sample precincts and then they compare their exit poll results to the actual tabulations as they're coming in. And that's how they make their predictions, and they're usually right on the money.
I also wondered how they tabulate it so fast. When like here in California, we vote with these punch cards.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get tabulated?
How do they tabulate exit poll?
No, not exit poll. I mean the actual vote. I mean, when I turn in, when I vote, I put that in the box. What happens after that?
Well, I assume that it varies by county across the country.
I guess Riverside did it by touch screen.
Right, Riverside, and I believe some parts of LA County and north of LA County as well.
So, how come there was this problem in Florida over the positioning of the arrow or the hole, I guess, of Buchanan and Gore? Was the card that they used a larger one rather than a smaller? Ours is very slim.
Right. Well, the one that we vote on here in Orange County is a vertical ballot, essentially with the names on the left and the punches on the right. In Palm County, Florida, the punch is actually in the middle, and both candidates' names are on the left and the right.
Right.
And so, with arrows pointing from the candidate's name to the appropriate punch, and so it's been alleged that some voters in that county had punched Buchanan's name as opposed to Gore's name. Now, I looked at an image of the ballot that's been forwarded around to listservs, pollster listservs, and so forth. And it seemed to me, looking at that image, which was published in the Sun Sentinel, that one could have easily mistaken a vote for Bush as a vote for Buchanan as well. because of the way in which the names were situated.
Despite above all these.
The ballot order showed Bush right. and then Gore, and then I believe either Howard Phillips or Harry Brown on the left side, and then Buchanan was on the right side, almost perfectly in between Gore and Bush. And so I'm not sure that argument is going to stand up. And furthermore, if we get into the business of turning around actual votes based on people's intentions, we are, I think, subverting the democratic system.
Because how would you know that they really
did that? Of course, no way. There's, of course, no way of proving it.
So there's no challenge, real challenge from that.
Signed affidavits, I don't think, are even going to be credibly considered, because once you voted, you voted. It's almost like it reminds me of the situation in Little Saigon, when a number of people were giving cash donations and then to particular charities, quote unquote charities, during the high tech protests, and then people wanted their money back. Well,
all right.
How on earth can you possibly expect a refund when you've stuffed a $10 bill into somebody's hand or into a box? simply, Dan, there's just no way of verifying,
right.
and hence the vote has to count.
You brought up this issue of this ethnic community, and do you think there was any ethnic factor in the vote?
Well, I think the polls show a continuing ethnic division between
blacks, for instance.
The African American vote is one of the most rock solid Democratic constituencies in the country, and proved it again in this election. I haven't seen any figures, or any substantial figures, on the Latino vote, only to know that Latino turnout in raw numbers may have increased, but as a percentage of the electorate did not substantially increase.
Because you would think in Florida, with a large Latino community, you know, that was shifted towards the Democrats, but it didn't, with among newly registered ones too.
Well, you're talking about Cuban Americans who
that's true.
Who vote and think politically much differently than other Latinos.
How would you compare the Cuban Latino Cuban community vote political attitude on voting, political stance on voting, to the Vietnamese American community? Are the Vietnamese American community as ideological in the voting practices?
I don't see the Vietnamese American community as being ideological per se. Both communities have undergone an experience with a communist regime that has in large part shaped their immigration to the United States and consequently shaped their political attitudes. That is the one basic similarity between the two communities that has led them into the natural party of anti-communists, the party of Richard Nixon et al. And so I think that common denominator aside, when you begin to look more deeply in the differences, particularly the cultural differences, there are pretty substantial differences between Vietnamese and Cuban Americans.
What do you mean? You did a survey recently, and what did that show?
Well, I've done two polls, one for the Orange County Register and one for the San Jose Mercury News,
right.
On the Vietnamese American community. I've done no polling, unfortunately, on the Cuban American community. What we do see in the Vietnamese American community is a gradual shift towards interest in domestic issues, as well as a small yet significant growing segment of the community that is becoming more independent and more a large D democratic. That is something that is a bit of a story, given the fact that through the 1980s,
right.
The Vietnamese American community was thought to be so solidly Republican.
And isn't it true that you've also found that anti-communism wasn't a big factor in the way they saw themselves?
It's not a big factor, but it's still a significant factor, and very understandably so.
It wasn't the most important.
It's not the most important, but you still have a very large percentage of the community that say that fighting communism is one of the most significant political issues in the community, roughly 40%.
Because, you know, that's what I found interesting with this guy that just got re-elected to his Garden Grove City Council, Mr. Van Tran, who is a, I guess, a commissioner, planning commissioner in the city. And he used to work as a legislative aide to this right-wing congressman, Robert Dornan, Bob Dornan, in Washington when he first got out of college, law school. And he was actually the first, or maybe he had just got out of UCI then, but he was the first Vietnamese-American to actually work in a congressional office in D.C., apparently. But yet I talked to him recently, and he said that he was more diplomatic than Dornan, although I don't think he disavowed his politics. And I know the gay group ECHO, Elections Committee of Orange County, found him totally unacceptable, even though he was running on a slate with two Democrats for Garden Grove. Do you think that he, you know, he didn't actually mention anti-communism in his race, and of course that's a city council race, so, you know, but I'm sure that before, when Tony Lam, who is the first elected official, and I guess Van Tran is the second publicly elected official,
right?
Why do you think that's an indicator of the fact that people are more interested in domestic issues, and that, you know, foreign policy is really kind of not that important, or what?
I think it's a reflection of Van being very conscientious of the, not only the mood of the electorate, but being conscientious of what a city council race entails.
Mm-hmm.
Van is not by nature an ideologue nor a rabble-rouser. Some of the most most fiercely anti-communist politicking in the community comes not from the community itself, but from outsiders who attempt to mobilize the community by using that as a superficial issue.
Like Dornan and other office shows, you mean? Other politicians, you mean?
I think a wide variety of people are probably guilty on that count.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know.
So they come and they think that's the only issue that Vietnamese Americans are concerned about. So they show up at high-tech video and, you know, scream and yell. But actually, there's a kind of a...
Well, it's a complex community.
Yeah.
And people have to realize that there are a lot of issues on the plate in the community other than simply fighting the communist government in Vietnam.
Do you think with this trade agreement that is, you know, closing, nearing signatures, and also Clinton going to Vietnam next week, that all this will get actually a lot of Vietnamese to speak out in favor of trade? Vietnamese Americans, I mean?
The recent poll that we conducted for the San Jose Mercury News found that over 70% of the Vietnamese community in the Bay Area believe that trade will benefit the country and the people in the country. And so it really puts, I think, politicians who have staked such a hardline position against Vietnam in a precarious position.
And even Southern California, the majority of the people polled in other polls, I think, not just yours, show that a majority of the people have actually gone back to Vietnam since 75.
Right. That is an increasing trend. And in polls, we're probably underreporting the percentage that are actually going back, because it still is to a large degree politically incorrect to discuss your travel back to Vietnam.
Why did it take so long for a second Vietnamese American to be elected to public office?
Well, there are organizational issues, and there are also there's also the simple issue of experience. It takes time to learn the political system and work your way up the political system to the point where you can hold elective office. Van Tran is a perfect example of someone who has patiently and diligently worked their way through the political system, first getting experience as a political aide, then serving on a volunteer city commission, and then running for city council, working his way gradually up the political ladder. And that simply takes time. The community, as we know it, has been here for 25 years. That's not a heck of a lot of time. The Cuban-American community is an interesting example because they've been more successful organizationally in electing officials to public office. I think that initially there was a hesitance among Vietnamese Americans to speak out and begin to take leadership roles, external leadership roles, in the community. And now it's beginning to happen. You saw the Westminster City Council race had three Vietnamese American candidates,
but they didn't get any.
They didn't get anywhere. If their primary constituency is Vietnamese American voters, which I don't know for a fact that it is,
right?
Then they simply split the vote among the three of them. And if the community were to coalesce behind a candidate the way that it did behind Van, I think that there is a very strong chance that someone would be elected in Westminster.
You know, I was actually surprised that, you know, maybe it's not that surprising, I'm told, in city municipal races that Democrats join with Republicans to try to get elected, because in the Garden Grove case, Broadwater, who was running for mayor, and Mark Rosen, who was running for re-election on city council, picked as his slate, as their slate, Van Tran, rather than this guy who had been active in the gay community, Chris Privat, who was on our show a few weeks before. Why do you think they, I mean, is that wise? I mean, is that the way to get, you know, I mean, they didn't need Van Tran, but why did they need Van Tran? I mean, they would have won anyway.
To quote Tip O'Neill, all politics is local, and everything at the local level is not only nominally nonpartisan, but I think you saw and you see continuous efforts to cross party lines in local elections because of the necessity in Garden Grove particularly, which right. is getting more and more competitive between the two major parties.
I looked at the donations that were given to that race, and a lot of actually Koreans voted for the two white candidates that that won, that got reelected. And there was actually a cross-ethnic support also. It wasn't just Vietnamese, although I think Van Tran got a lot of support from Vietnamese community, including $500 from the local representative of the National United Front for the Liberation of Vietnam, which is a guerrilla group turned into a lobbying group. But the Do Diem gave him $500. And, you know, Susan Dong Matsuda gave him $100. And so, you know, he got, you know, bits and pieces from different people, from, you know, restaurant owners and stuff like that. So he had actually a lot of donations.
Well, he also had broad-based support outside the community. And he had to have, because if you look at the returns, he pretty much dominated the election. And
those were the three top vote getters, right?
Rosen and him got the list. But Van was at the top of the list.
Yeah, I think it's true what you said about him, that he has a kind of a more mellow kind of, in, as opposed to Dolan, who tends to get people really upset. But you know, he's very diplomatic. He seeks out people. He talks to a lot of people, and he's really willing to talk to people that don't agree with him.
Van has built his reputation as a moderate and one who builds bridges. Beginning to sound like a campaign commercial, but it really is true. I think of what you've read about him, and if you talk to him personally, you do know that that's the case.
And he was a co-founder of the Project NOC at UC Irvine, that was helping refugees in camps in Asia, especially Hong Kong. Do you think that, you wanted to make a point about...
I was going to talk more about the Nader vote.
Right.
Because what you see in the Nader vote is really fascinating, because in the coastal communities, Nader got as much as 15% of the vote in some counties. Mendocino County, Humboldt County, and San Francisco County, he did quite well. These are all all counties where the Democrats are the overwhelming majority party. It's very interesting to watch these coastal communities as progressive alternative candidates are offered. It's very interesting to watch these communities begin to shift and support these candidates over the establishment Democrats who have really dominated politics for such a long time.
But if NATO was the attraction rather than the Greens, are you saying that you're not going to see a trend towards registering as a Green Party member then?
Well, you may see more of a trend now because NATO ran a very visible campaign. But the trend towards registering either as an independent or with an alternative party is going on despite a Nader campaign. It's a cultural generational trend, and it seems to me irrevocable until there's some sort of realignment in the party system.
Is it among younger and newer voters, newer registrants? That's the
trend. And if you look at the exit poll data, you see a lot. You see that Nader support is coming from, even though we are talking about a small percentage of the vote, which makes exit polls a little more difficult to trust. But nonetheless, you'll see that Nader support comes from three primary constituencies. One is the 18 to 29 age group.
Right.
The second is the group that voted for Perot, identifies as an independent rather than with one of the two major parties.
Mm-hmm.
And the third demographic is that they are not affiliated with any religion. I think that there is definitely something going on here when you see a relationship between the Perot vote. Between the vote for Jesse Ventura in Minnesota, which drew from many of the same constituencies,
right,
and the vote for Ralph Nader. Jesse Ventura and Ralph Nader have about as much in common, but there is this underlying constituency, and I would say I don't dare call it a movement, because a movement, by its very definition, implies organization and coherence. It's not coherent and it's not organized, but there is something going on, folks, and it's clearly expressing itself as alternative candidates are waging campaigns.
It almost implies godless communism.
No comment, man.
You know, then if the young people are more likely to register independent, new voters, whatever, new registrants, why? How come they're not voting? I mean, why are people still,
for the same 50% reason,
people don't vote?
For the same reason why young people have never voted. They simply have better things to do with their time. maybe perhaps listening to this radio show for one,
maybe.
Or studying for their, where are we? Are we almost in midterm exams? And thirdly, lack of connection to the political system at a young age, perhaps still on mom and dad's payroll, and not having had the experience of supporting oneself, paying taxes other than sales taxes, and having to deal with government on a day-to-day basis. Young voters or young folks have not yet been fully incorporated into the system, and so that's why they're not participating.
So are you saying they're more likely to turn into anarchists?
If they hang around you long enough, Dan, yeah.
Well, even one anarchist I met who, you know, I've interviewed, he said that he was going to vote for NADA as a protest vote, because a lot of anarchists were actually there protesting NADA when he showed up at Chapman.
A genuine anarchist isn't going to vote at all.
Well, I mean, he's making a statement, I guess.
Well, he's making a statement within the political system, which I think by its very nature undercuts his anarchy.
I know, and I've been called an anarchist, and I actually did vote. So, the contradictions of American life under this global capitalism. So, you know, once you wrote, you co-wrote a piece for the Journal of Theoretical Politics, Why Democrats Shouldn't Vote. I wanted to end with that, or at least get you to say why you wrote that article.
Oh, that's...
has nothing to do with anything.
In fact, that really has nothing to do with anything. That was a gonzo piece of academic work that was written by my advisor at the time, Bernie Grofman, using some of my data. So I can pretty much deflect all of that over to Bernie.
So anyway, so that wasn't your opinion.
Bernie. That was a gonzo piece, and so I wouldn't take the title literally.
So it was almost like an op-ed.
No. It was a piece of attempted academic comedy.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I always take you to be very serious.
Oh, for some reason everyone does.
Are you going to teach at UCI again?
I'll be teaching at UCI, of course.
Do you prefer to be a teacher rather than a poster, or you want to do both?
Well, teaching keeps me in touch with academia, with academic work and scholarship, as well as mentoring and educating students, two things that I enjoy. Polling actually gets me involved in the community and involved in the real day-to-day issues. And as a pollster, most people that do polling realize this, of course, but you do have an impact on political discourse, social discourse, by really being able to understand public opinion and being able to articulate it. You can have quite a substantial impact on the community. And so, in a larger sense, polling does fit that personal interest of mine.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for coming in and dropping by and talking about what happened yesterday.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. That was Chris Collette, professor of political science and also a poster. This is Subversity. Before we end, some announcements. Tonight, there will be a speaker from Columbia University, pioneer in African American studies. Mr. Manning Marabo will be speaking at Crystal Cove Auditorium at 7 o'clock at UC Irvine. This is all part of the Rainbow Festival this year. And then on Thursday night at 7 o'clock also, there'll be a panel on national security and Asian American scientists, the treatment of Wen Ho Lee, including former scientists from Los Alamos and Ling Chi Wang, who heads the Asian American Studies program, ethnic studies program, whatever, at UC Berkeley. And also at Occidental on Tuesday, there'll be a talk given all day at different events during the day by the daughter of Wen Ho Lee, Alberta Lee. And for more information about that, you can look at, write to, or check the website www.oxy.edu/tildelimy/psa.htm. So tildelimy/psa.htm. and the original URL is www.oxy.edu. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity. The opinions expressed on this show were not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Spam, eat the rich.
This is Subversity, the public affairs show that penetrates the orange curtain, smashes conventional norms, and transgresses more and more boundaries each week here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Orange County. And I'm tired of being